Good morning. Ingo and I will present our presentation. And since Ingo is deaf, it will be translated from sign language to English and vice versa by our interpreters, Silke Brendel Evan and Ralf Wiebel, and we are very grateful for their help. So David came about 1 hour ago to our office and said, why don't you give a talk just using chalk? I'm kidding a little bit. And I told him, well, if I would have known at midnight, we could have switched, but now it's too late. So of course we have our presentation prepared. But I promise I will use the chalk during the first 5 minutes. And maybe that can already be the end, because the topic is entirely open, and one can even start discussing of the definitions. So I think control is an old theme in physics and chemistry and biology and related. And so there have been many, many concepts since hundreds of years. For example, chemists like to change the pressure or the temperature, or they use light. And that brings us closer to the scene. So they have used light to influence chemical reactions, for example. And that would bring us to the traditional field of photochemistry. Now in this field, now I'm focusing on this traditional old field, what you do is you go from an initial field, initial state, and you go to a final state, and you use light. And the chemist would write H nu to say, well, there's a certain frequency of your laser. Essentially, you put energy into your system, and then something will go on. So usually on this type of control, or sometimes this type of control is called a passive control. Whereas we want to do something different. So we want to do quantum control. And then we have certain laser fields. And again, we go from initial state to a final state, but we call it active control. And now this has more than one parameter. So I draw here a field, and this has a frequency, omega, but it also has a phase, for example. It can have a duration, many parameters, and in principle it can have an infinite or quasi-infinite number of parameters. And then we can apply, of course, different intensities or field strengths, which will bring us eventually to strong fields, and this can bring us to very short pulses. It can bring us to the femto or to the attosecond time domain. So we are in this field and in this area here, and we will use the electric fields, not the magnetic fields. So this is, we focus on electric fields. Next week, I look much forward to learning about influence of magnetic fields. Also, I can think of combinations, but this is not our topic today. So, from the general field, we will talk about quantum control of matter by light, and that's the electric part of the light. And the matter will in general be molecules. And these molecules can be free molecules in the gas, or they could be condensed. So that's a kind of introduction with the chalk, and now I switch to the prepared PowerPoint presentation. And I was so the theme is from nuclear, from control of nuclear dynamics to electron dynamics and back. And I could start with a quotation from the Bible. In German we call it Kohelet. I don't know the Hebrew pronunciation, but that has many, many very wise...
Switch off the light at the top.
Yep. The Kohelet has many, many wise, wise advices. And one of them is very famous. It says, there is nothing new under the sun. And in fact, when you want to give a talk about the history of this field, it is not so easy, and you are never 100% sure when it really started. So I present to you my view, and I think during the whole workshop or so, a more clear picture will come up. So I will start with a selected overview of approaches to control of nuclear dynamics, and the selectivity is with an eye on those approaches which later have been used or applied with some variations to control of electrons. And I'm sure that this is not complete, but it should be, say, it should set a frame. And we are very interested in learning from you about more concepts that we should take into account.
If I may interrupt, maybe we can move the overhead.
Yeah, because it's difficult to see the...
Just lower it, just lower it by one turn. Where is the screw?
This is good.
Okay.
That would be nice to see the heading. Okay, that's good. Okay, so we will go through a historic tour, and you are welcome to interrupt because we are from different fields. To some of you, this frame is very familiar; for others, not so much. So this is by history. And as I said, it is difficult to say where it really starts. For us, the work of Paramonov turned out to be very important, so I start with that approach, although one could ask whether this is already a control. So what Paramonov did, first of all, he published in the Soviet Union in Russian, and nobody read his papers. This is the only one which was published in the Western journal from that time. Essentially what he did was, or what he did in theory, was to use so-called pi pulses, which achieve in an ideal sense 100% population transfer from, in this case, a vibrational ground state to an excited state. Later that turned out to be very useful in the whole field. So this is not yet a control of a reaction, a dynamics, it is just a vibrational excitation. So in that case, the initial state is a vibrational ground state, for example, and then final state is an excited state. And he used a pi pulse, so this is a laser pulse, which is designed such as to achieve 100% population transfer. Now these pi pulses are not, he was not the first to do this. The pi pulses are well known already in the 70s in the optical sciences. People like Ravi or other names are there. So this means the history is somehow even going further back. But concerning the nuclear dynamics, maybe that was in one of the initial steps. Now the field really, in my view, really started with this fundamental work by Tanner and Rice. And that work is fundamental in two aspects. One of them is they suggested a very famous scheme, the so-called pump-dump or pump-and-control scheme, which essentially does the following. So you start from a reactant, so our initial state is now some reactant species, and then a laser pulse is used to excite this to an excited state. Oh yeah, that's helpful, thank you. So now we are in an excited state, and that means it is no longer in an eigenstate. The system starts to evolve to another configuration, and then in the right moment, depending on the time delay, using a second pulse called a dump pulse, that could also be another exciting pulse. There are many variants of this scheme. Then they form the target state, which will eventually evolve to products at your will. This was a very famous scheme, and everybody knows about it. And you see the parameters of the lasers are not just one. It's not just the photon energy here, but, or the frequency, but there's also the delay time between the pulses. And there could be more parameters. Like here in the case, we have the frequency, the intensity, and the duration of the pulse. Now I said this had a double starting point of the field. One is the scheme. The second one is also, this was the start of optimal control, with however restricted to weak fields. But the concepts of optimal control are already in this paper. And in fact, it turns out if one applies optimal control theory with the constraint of weak fields, then you kind of automatically end up with the scheme. And I'm sure we will hear more about this during the talk, as Stuart Rice will also attend later on. Okay, so this was in 1985, which was in some way really the start of the field in this area of quantum control of nuclear dynamics. Shortly after, Bruma and Shapiro entirely independently came up with their very famous scheme of what they call coherent control. And originally, this was a scheme not for laser pulses, but for continuous waves, so infinitely long laser pulses. But later on, this was also modified, and many variations were invented. So essentially, what they apply is, well, they start from the initial state, and they want to go to the target state, which can be either this or this. And they do it by using two different paths, or maybe more different paths. For example, three photon excitation versus a single photon excitation. And then they apply coherent light. And using the different phases of coherent light, of the superposition of laser fields with such frequencies, they found that the preparation of the product depends on the phase. And that's certainly not one of the traditional parameters of the energy, just the energy. But see, again, it's at least two pulses, so we are in active control, and that was their scheme. Now, I'm also a little bit proud of being one of these old pioneers, because in the same year, 1986, again, completely independently and not knowing or not paying attention to the pioneering works here, we made another suggestion, namely, also not knowing about Paramanov's work, we applied a pi pulse to a system which had already been excited to a so-called resonance state in the continuum, which decays to the products. And we applied a pi pulse to convert this resonance state to another resonance, which has a different modus of decay, for example, a faster decay. And so that way we introduced infrared laser pulses into the field of quantum control in 1986. So, 2 years later, Rabitz and co-workers introduced optimal control for arbitrary, for strong fields. That's the same general concept as was introduced by Tanner and Rice, but they were the first to show how to do this for strong fields. So in that case, we have infinite number of parameters, and their first paper here was on control of vibrational energy transfer through a chain molecule from one side to the other side. The same year, 1988, Bergmann and co-workers introduced the famous Dirac approach. That is a little bit similar to the Tanner-Rice pump-dump approach, but Bergmann applied this pump and dump laser pulses in the counterintuitive way. So first the dump pulse and then the pump pulse, and that turned out to be a very successful and very robust way of controlling matters. Originally, also this was quite independent. One can go into the history, but I will not go into too many details. It was really a quite independent approach originally and very successful till today. Then in 1989, Kosloff, Rice, Tanner and co-workers, also in a very fundamental paper in a special issue of Chemical Physics, where I happen to be the guest editor, so I know that paper very well, very proud of having that in the special issue, they introduced the so-called local optimal control. Now, optimal control versus local optimal control, I think to see the difference is a very important technical distinction. And if you allow me, I will not go into the details right now, but I just want to give an overview. The essentials of the local optimal control is that this is a very efficient method which propagates the wave function and subject to the laser field, and during the propagation the method is very clever and designs the change of the laser pulse which will be most suitable in the next moment to go to the final target. And this way of local optimal control, so at every instance to decide what should be the best way of the laser field to go to the target at the moment, that's what's meant by local optimal control. That's very successful, and by the way, there has been a review by David together with Volker Engels, came out last year. I recommend that very much for this year. I must also say that these are just the pioneering papers, and of course there are many follow-ups, many big names, but I will not mention all of them. So then, in this list, I think very important work in 1990 by Bandrauk and Korkum and Tchaikovsky. They could show that depending on the situation, it will be very favorable to use laser pulses with so-called chirping. For example, if you want to dissociate a molecule, so you start from a vibrational ground state and you climb a ladder till you reach the dissociation, so that's the target. So the initial state is the ground state, the final state in this case is dissociation. They looked at the unharmonic level spacing and had a very clever idea that if you want to climb the ladder, then it will be good to lower the frequency from the energy gap between the first two levels to the second and make it lower and lower. And this should be very sufficient, and they showed that this is indeed a very practical way, a very successful way. So they introduced chirped laser pulses into the field. Then, in 1991, meanwhile there was the fall of the Iron Curtain, you remember, and that allowed Paramonov to go to the West, and we sat together and we merged our two approaches and designed a scheme which reminds of the Kozlov of the tunnel rise pump and dump approach, but there's something different which I want to emphasize and to point out since it's my right as a speaker here. So you see, the scheme is basically okay. What is the initial state? This is say one isomer of the chemical reaction. This coordinate here is a reaction path, and this minimum is for one reactant, and this is for a product. And the initial state is one isomer, and the final state is the other isomer. And the challenge is to design laser pulses which will bring the reactant to the product. And our suggestion was, well, apply the infrared laser pulses, go from the initial state to we can call it a transition state, which is above the barrier. And typically these transition states close in energy to the barrier are delocalized. So if you excite the system from here to this delocalized state, it has some probability here, but it also has some probability here. And then apply a second pulse, which brings us from this, let's call it transition state, to the product state. So in theory, this is very successful, depending on the system, of course. And I want to point a little bit to the difference to the Tanner-Rice scheme. The Tanner-Rice scheme excites the system to a superposition of eigenstates here. That makes it time-dependent, and typically a wave function will travel from here to here, whereas we excite the system to an eigenstate. That makes a difference, because in the approach of Tanner and Rice, what matters is the proper time delay, which is it's just the time the time-dependent wave packet travels from the, say, from the domain of the reactants to the products. In our case, when we use an eigenstate as a transition state, the time delay is not an important parameter, because an eigenstate is, of course, time independent. So what matters here is really we use a pi pulse. First pi pulse to excite the system to an eigenstate, and then the second pi pulse to prepare the product. And of course, there are bridges between the two concepts, and we acknowledge the priority of the Tanner-Rice concept, but still the details are, of course, different.
You have a question here?
Yes.
Can you say a bit more what the states are? Is it a system that is described by a Schrödinger equation?
Yes.
And what does the laser come into?
Laser? Okay. This is already, this opens a big button. So in our case, we use the Hamiltonian, which is written in semi-classical dipole approximation as the molecular Hamiltonian minus the dipole coupling with the electric field. And I think during this workshop we will discuss a lot that there are different and in fact better ways you should use the vector field to do this. All this can be done. But for this specific application, we use the so-called electric dipole approximation. I guess that will be similar to the magnetic dipole approximation that will be used by the NMR people. But this is something I want to learn here.
Jörn, I have a question.
Please.
Can you comment on if you do a pi pulse,
okay,
the first step,
right,
then you've transferred everything from your initial state to the upper state.
Right.
And now when you come into the second pi pulse,
yes,
how do you know that you end up on the right side?
These levels are this is a system which is slightly asymmetric. So we have different laser parameters, and they are chosen such that we know we go only in one direction. Yeah.
Since you mentioned strong and weak fields, we hear that strong fields come in. Can you disquantitatively say
what was? Go back. So the definition of strong versus weak field, there are many different ways of making the borderline between this. And I see Professor Sein smiling already. I think he will this will be an important part of his talk. So I will not go into too many details. So one way of distinguishing this is whether you can still apply perturbation theory or not. And in this sense, the Tunnel-Rice-Pandan scheme turned out to be in the frame of perturbation theory. So they have the general ansatz for optimal control, but subject to a solution within the frame of perturbation theory that gives the Pandan field. But there are other definitions, and for example, André Bandrau can give other definitions. He introduced very strong fields which will reshape the molecular potential and the surfaces like causing weak bond softening or bond strengthening such things, which are also non-perturbative. So they are
rest states.
Okay, so in this sense, our solutions are certainly non-perturbative, and in this sense they are strong fields. But if you go to the relativistic people who really apply strong fields so that not only the electric field but also the magnetic field is important, etc., then we are still in the weak field domain. So I think we must... It depends on to whom you are talking. So in our... It's non-perturbative, and in this sense it is strong field.
Maybe just to step
yes.
About,
if you
can go back for a second.
Yes.
One more.
Okay. Yes.
So in the 85 paper with Rice, yeah. So that was the model was developed within perturbation theory, as Jorn said. If you go to the 89 paper,
right,
Kozlov, we actually used the same system, but we used there we had, and even the same mechanism came out, but we did it with control theory, so the fields were strong. In other words, you can go up and then go up, evolve on the excited surface, come down within second order perturbation theory. Or you can go up and essentially transfer close to 100% upstairs, create a wave packet that comes down, and create a wave packet that moves and then comes down with almost 100%. So in other words, we can have very similar dynamics, but in one case, it's 1% or 1% product. In the other case, it's 99 of 99% product with the same mechanism. It's not true for every type of control system, but in this particular case of two pulses that are well separated in time, you actually get a very similar dynamical mechanism within the weak field approach and within the strong field.
When did you put in the constraint that you must not go above a certain intensity, because then you get ionization? I remember I used to refer in paper, not yours, but other people, and they were using horrendously high intensity, and I mean, it's clear the system would ionize.
Right.
So, I think you introduced those constraints, I forget who it was.
In the first paper, 1985, we had, it's interesting, because, you know, I didn't know optimization theory, and at first, when I started to work on this, I thought to just do an unconstrained optimization of the field, but I was working with the second order perturbation theory. And then what came out was meaningless, because you get more and more product by just making the field strong. Within perturbation theory, you get more and more product by making the field stronger and stronger. So I put in a constraint on a total integral of E squared, and then that meant that you have essentially a fixed number of photons, and then you get rewarded only for how you shape the field. And so that was already in the first paper in 85. But then that constraint was then carried over later on into all the optimal control work. There's a variation on the if you have a constraint, a hard constraint on the number of photons of the fluence of the field, then you use what's called the Lagrange multiplier. But if you can also make it a softer constraint, and then the same object becomes what's called a penalty function. Right? And both approaches have been used, and there are advantages and disadvantages for both.
My recollection is that this applies also to a paper by Brunner and Shapiro, because they are third order of perturbation theory for three photons transition. There are quantum interferences because there are two paths leading to the same final state, but still you have to remain within the frame. Maybe intensity is low enough for not getting higher terms coming into play. That was my
right. Yeah, absolutely.
Has been overcome since then. So it's more tomorrow and now. You can go to more people beyond pretty far beyond the perturbation.
There have been so many developments. These are just the pioneering.
May I also make a comment since we're talking about literature? The paper, the Stirrup paper that you mentioned is actually not the first. The whole class of Stirrup-like passages was proposed first in the 1983 paper by Oreck, Hugh, and Eberle. And then Bergman was the one who actually implemented this 6 years later in an experiment. And the point I want to make is that it's a pity that Eberle and others, they proposed a whole class of schemes, and Stirrup just is only one of them. And that it's like a four-page paper, and they just solve a general algebraic problem. And then Bergman chose one which was easiest in his experimental case. And in other experimental cases, other classes of controls proposed by those people might be easier now, but they're completely forgotten. Mm-hmm.
Well, thank you so much. I mean, that's why we are here to learn about these forgotten sources. So I will appreciate very much if you can kindly give the reference.
My understanding, unless you have direct evidence to the contrary, my understanding is that Bergman wasn't aware of the Eberle work when he did his experiments.
I don't know.
Because I've talked with him, and what he basically described is that he had these two pulses, and he just decided he was going to do an experiment where he tested the dependence as a function of a parameter, which is essentially the time ordering of the two pulses. And he had some kind of intuition restoring the effect.
Actually, he didn't have pulses. It's even more interesting. So he moved the laser beam through. He had a molecular beam which he moved through the laser and gets.
So there was no pulse shaping at that time. So that's why Stirrup came about. And now with the pulse shaping, it would be nice if somebody could go back and check all the other cases, which might be easier with pulse shaping.
So I'm very grateful for any reference which will be added here. Okay, then on the bottom line here, this is a very, very important and fundamental paper by Rabitz, who then introduced the field which goes under different names, for example, the evolutionary algorithm, the feedback learning. And I think during this workshop we will hear a lot of this. Later on it turned out to be that this is very successfully on the experimental side. So this has to be praised on this list without going into the details. In the connection of our target to go to electron control, it's quite important, the work by Henriksen and co-workers, who already in 1992 introduced a combination of infrared plus UV laser pulses in order to control molecular nuclear dynamics. In his case, again, the initial state was the ground state, and the target state, the finite state, was the dissociation of a selective bond breaking. So he wanted selectively to break the bond AB, B and C, and not AB, for example. And the task of the infrared pulse in this case was to excite the system vibrationally such that the bond BC gets pre-elongated, and then in the right moment at the maximum pre-elongation, a short UV pulse is applied to break this B plus C bond. And we will see the same principle later was applied to control of electron dynamics.
Yes, this is sometimes called vibrationally mediated dissociation.
Right. That term was used earlier by
Fleming
Krim. Yes, by Fleming Krim and also Imrie and Schinke.
There.
But they did not use laser pulses, so they had CW pre-excitations. Okay, that should also be taken into account. But they were the first to apply laser pulses, and when the time delay between these two pulses matters, or in fact, the UV pulse is very short, and when you put the UV pulse, depending on the phase of the infrared, so that principle is already in Armstrong's paper, in Henriksen's paper, Niels Henriksen. Then in 1996, I make here a claim, and maybe you can correct me immediately. I think we were, together with Paramonov and Korolkov, we were the first to do the this type of control in open systems. So the system that you want to control, coupled to a bath.
Well, in 1993, okay. We applied okay.
Okay.
Yes.
Very good. I'm happy to learn about it and to include the reference. Okay, so thank you. So what we could show, there were different things, of course. Here the methods had to be developed, how to take into account the dissipation. So this was done using not the Schrödinger equation, but the Liouville equation with dissipative terms. And concerning the concepts, what was very interesting is that usually you think that if you have dissipation, that is somehow your enemy, because dissipation is somehow distributing the energy, and then it's not there, and it makes life harder. But we could show in this paper that sometimes dissipation, maybe you call it decoherence, I don't know, can also be a friend to control it. Namely, in this case, we could apply a convenient laser pulse which doesn't bring the system down immediately to the ground state here, but to some excited state. This turned out to be quite convenient. Then from here, the system will relax. And this relaxation helps to stabilize the target state, the product state. So in this case, dissipation was a friend of control. And the list goes on, and there were many, many applications, and I don't want to be all too comprehensive, but I want to focus on the topic from nuclear to electron. And so the last thing I put on this historic list is relatively recent. I think this paper by Van Raok and co-workers is the first which really introduces into control of nuclear dynamics the concept of the carrier envelope phase. I'm not aware of an earlier paper, and we will see later this has to do with the from nuclear dynamics to electron and back. I think the experience with the control of electron dynamics when you use the carrier envelope phase, you will see this later. I just guess, I don't know Andre's head so well, but I think that could have been some intuition which guides him to apply the same principle also to control of nuclear dynamics. So far this introduction. Okay, so now control of electron dynamics, and this will also be a little bit by history, but the control of electron dynamics didn't went by the same order of as the people developed these approaches for the nuclear dynamics. So I, to the best of my knowledge, the first quantum control of electron dynamics was not introduced by the attosecond laser pulses, but it was introduced already in 1989, so now we have 20 years of this field, by Boomer and Shapiro, namely by coherent control of the directionality of the flux of electrons in conduction bands. And that was later on also verified experimentally. So I think in some sense this is paper number one in this field, to the best of my knowledge of the literature, but if you have something earlier, please. Okay, but really the bulk of control of electron dynamics, this was really stimulated by the availability of the attosecond laser pulses, which are on the time scale of electron motions. So that field really started essentially in the early of our present decade, in the early years. And now this, as I said, doesn't go really historically now, but by the mechanisms. So earlier I have shown to you this pump-dump approach by Kosloff and Rice, and also our pump-dump infrared, which goes via pi pulses. And the same scheme, namely a control of electron dynamics via pi pulses, was applied, to my knowledge, the first time by the group of Seifrank, and really Tillmann Kleinroth is the main player here. What they did, if you see it here, so they have one pump pulse for exciting the system electronically, and then a pump pulse, and the effect of these pulses is to induce electron transfer. So usually the lithium, the atom, is slightly positive, but then in the excited state it can change, and then they bring it down to another state and they switch again. So this is now a control of the electron distribution in the molecule using, and this they also acknowledge, using the concepts which were designed for nuclear dynamics. And they also did it in a dissipative environment. And again, the results are pretty much similar to the experience that we had for nuclear dynamics. So, for example, they put the molecule on the surface, and the surface provides dissipation. And that is a competing effect which they have to overcome using this pi pulse control. Now here's something that where I put a question mark. I was looking for examples that carry over the basic concept of the tunnelized pump-dump approach to electron control, not using pi pulses, but using just pump-dump or dump-pump and control laser pulses. And till now I couldn't find something. So if you have something, then I will be happy. So this is a possibility of this approach, which is implied by the beautiful work of Remarque and Levine. So what they do is they start in the initial state from a ground state of the molecule, and then they apply, say, the first laser pulse, the pump pulse, to ionize the system. After ionization, it is no longer in the eigenstate, and the electrons start to move. And you see they are moving on an attosecond time scale. This is half a femtosecond, so we are attoseconds. And within less than one femtosecond, the electrons are transferred from one end of the molecule to another one. See here. And then back again. And in principle, this ultra-fast laser-induced electron transfer could of course be used if you now apply a second pulse. You can somehow manipulate the system on the other side and do something. But I think this second pulse has never been applied. And all this series of works was initiated by some experimental work, but that was on a nanosecond time scale. And so it was not really done by two attosecond laser pulses, but there's a possibility.
In the calculation, they just assume.
Yes, right. They have a delta pulse laser, so they kick off the electron to dissociation in the model, and then they see what happens. So there's still a lot to be done. I just want to say that I have no analogy in electron control for the panelized scheme. Now here's a very recent, 2006, application of the optimal control in the strong field sense, so non-perturbative. It was done by Klamroth. You have seen the name before, and he applies the optimal control equations. We will not.
If we take this famous three-step mechanism for harmonic generation, you have in the first step you have the tunnel ionization,
right?
And then you have the electron comes
right.
back and you
get right.
generation of high harmonics.
Mm-hmm.
But you could imagine that you come in, let's say, with a second pulse to somehow manipulate the returning electron and how it collides with the atom.
Yeah, I think there are many scenarios, but I have a lot of high harmonic generation on the next transparencies, but I'm not really aware that somebody already did it. So, but we can learn.
Not because you need one femtosecond pulses.
Right.
Only two or three people have them. Right.
Right.
And you need two of them, well timed and coherent, and
right.
it's so.
But we're theoreticians.
Oh yeah, yeah.
So we can dream, and
sure.
And we can.
Mm.
But one of the things that might be interesting would be to ask what can be done with pulse combinations.
We did optimal control theory. With one thing, we tried to make a nanosecond pulse from harmonic generation, and the answer was that you have to have even an odd harmonics, and you have to have equal phase of all the harmonics, which is what you, as theorists, knew already. So the algorithm just gave us what we already understood.
I would like to continue the question because I've been thinking about this too. Can you achieve shaping nanosecond pulses by, first of all, ionizing a specifically shaped electronic wave in the first place, so that when it comes, it has a design shape, or it's just how much work is being done on shaping nanoseconds?
Very little. There's no, to the best of my knowledge, there's no automatic tool to shape attosecond pulses, but they are working on it.
I should maybe say that, the problem with this shaping the wave packet is that you are now really stretching the three-step model, which is a simplified model. And in reality, of course, you don't have a separate electron wave packet which just freely revolves and comes back, as it is implied by this model. In reality, of course, the whole thing remains a coherent state interacting, and so it's a little bit tricky to discuss here simple manipulation schemes on this electron wave packet, not considering that it's not really free and released and can be manipulated in a certain instant in time. think this is something that has to be taken into account.
Is this a technical difficulty or a conceptual difficulty?
It's a conceptual problem. I mean, you have to be really careful what you're speaking of. The three-step model is a very simplified picture, which seems to be very nice, but in detail, if you do the full calculation, you will not see it in this simplified flow. And therefore, just to build on the simple model some manipulation scheme can be very problematic.
So is the reason that you don't see it, is it because the electronic wave function is delocalized, so there's no delocalized time at which it comes back?
But I think this is a topic of its own, and this
we
can
talk tomorrow, I guess.
Yes, but it's because it's a very small part of the wave function.
Yeah.
It's extremely small because the harmonic generation yield is 10^-6 or 7. So it's only a very small part of the wave function which is undergoing this kind of.
If there's nothing left in the ground state, you get no harmonics.
So, of course.
Yeah, come back to your previous example.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So, there we were posing the question to which extent this can be analogous to the Tanner Rice scheme. Mm-hmm. So, you said the pump pulse, so to say, here ionizes the system and in this way creates a wave packet, which in this case seems to be a charge transfer, electrons
right.
go from one side of
right.
the other. The other
yeah.
impact and so on. Now, what would be the target here? That
the target could be.
What pulse should achieve? Okay. Should it be an eigenstate of the ionized system? Or
well, there can be many targets, and this also leads to such fundamental questions whether. Electron dynamics will lead nuclear dynamics or vice versa, and that can depend on many scenarios. So one thing they have in mind or they are thinking about is that, for example, as a consequence of this, one can more easily break some bond on the other side and then manipulate this big molecule in some way or to induce some isomerization. Because it's now in a different electronic environment. That's
still controlling the machine. Yeah.
No, no. Well, at the very end, yes. But
would it be conceivable to have as target ground state of the ionized
Big challenge, yeah. To stop the electron transfer. Good challenge. I think it's open to so many goals.
Yeah, very interesting goal.
Yeah. Okay. So now we already discussed a lot about the harmonic generation.
Just 1 second. It was a workshop in Minnesota in March of bringing together mathematicians and physicists, chemists, interested in control. And you were at that.
No. I organized another one in Montreal.
Anyway, one of the talks by mathematician was about actually the problem of optimal control of having some kind of container with water in it and moving it while minimizing sloshing. So, and there are some specialized techniques for solving these kinds of problems. So, mm-hmm. It might be actually be relevant to minimizing electron sloshing. So.
Actually, if you hear me talk about Tommaso Calarco, this is the example that he always uses, that the waiter, when he carries glasses, he like this.
Sorry, would you please repeat it? We didn't get it.
Oh, I'm sorry. There is a well-known in the community fellow called Tommaso Calarco, and what he does, he applies numerical optimal control on top of some intuitive scheme that he has in his mind. So it's kind of combination of the two. And he gives this example that a waiter, you know, if you were to carry a few glasses of wine, the intuitive way to carry it would be just like this, but you'll splash it. So what the waiters do, and the waiter is a kind of nature enforced optimal genetic control idea. His waiter carries it like this.
Mm-hmm.
No, like this.
Mm-hmm.
See, can you interpret it because you used your hands when you spoke.
Well, you know, there's a classical trick, like if you want to stick on your hand, you don't want it to fall down, you have to run with it. That's mm-hmm. one of the results of optimal control theory.
Yeah, you can stabilize, moving in the perpendicular direction, you've got to keep moving with it.
Okay. So you can see from this discussion, it's so really so very stimulating. But I would like to bring us back to the flow of the task. The idea was to show examples where concepts which were developed for the control of nuclear dynamics were taken over to the control of electron dynamics. And you remember that André Van Rauk and co-workers introduced the chirping for control of nuclear dynamics, and little wonder they have a paper on using chirped laser pulses in order to improve the generation of harmonics. And I don't want to go in any details here because André can do that much better. I just want to say that the concepts have been carried over from nuclear to electron dynamics. Now we come to lots of papers on control of high harmonic generations. This is a list of the achievements, experimental ones. So the world record now is 45 at a second. And there have been lots of applications for molecular orbital tomography. And this is a prediction, yeah. This is a real world, and this is a prediction. Okay. Okay, you have to distinguish this.
Isn't the Milano group lower for you? Experimental side?
Okay, this is... This table has to be updated every 3 months. Yeah. So here's also control of electron transfer, like you have seen before, but in a very small system. H3+ to induce Coulomb explosion. Just a hint. Here's, in my mind, a very nice analogy of electron control compared to nuclear control using this concept of a combination of infrared and UV laser pulse. So this was introduced by Becker, and it was submitted. I don't know what happened to the paper. And a similar idea was introduced by Ivanov together with Volker Engel. This is Gräfes. So essentially they use infrared pulse to manipulate part of the system and then a UV pulse to manipulate other parts of the electronic system. Let me be such very coarse right now without going into the details. I just want to emphasize concepts of infrared plus UV have been transferred from nuclear to electron dynamics. Then there are lots of, not a lot, but a couple of pioneering papers who introduced something really new which was not available for nuclear dynamics, and that brings me to the from nuclear to electron and back. So in the field of electron control, it was recognized very early by Van Rauk, but also here by De Vive Riedle and by the group of Kling in cooperation with many famous people, including Krauss and Bucking and Drescher and others, that the outcome of a reaction depends on the carrier envelope phase of the laser pulse. I mean, that was used to manipulate, first of all, electron dynamics, and as a consequence, also it has consequences for the nuclear dynamics. And for example, here they can break this molecule in order to make a deuterium plus deuteron, or vice versa. In other words, they can drive the remaining electron to one nucleus or to the other one. And where, when the molecule breaks apart, the question where will the electron sit, here or here, will depend on the carrier electron envelope phase of the laser pulse. And this has been demonstrated theoretically and also experimentally in this work. So that was something that was not available, but I told you already. The concepts were developed by Bandrock, and he put it back to the control of nuclear dynamics. We have seen that earlier. Also, something that I'm not so aware in the domain of nuclear dynamics is that laser pulses can be used to break symmetry, but as I'm sure you, some of you know some nice examples. In the case of electron dynamics, here's a nice example of symmetry breaking laser pulses, and maybe that could be a challenge to try something similar for control of nuclear dynamics. Just want to indicate this topic. Then, if you do ionization of a system, for example, of a hydrogen atom, then you kick off an electron, and you could, in principle, control the directionality of the, in which direction will the electron fall apart. And this was demonstrated by Madsen and co-workers using circularly polarized laser pulses. So they ionize the system, and then depending on the parameters of the pulse, on the phase envelope, they can shoot the electron in given directions. So you see, for example, here, depending on the phase of the laser pulse, they can shoot it in this direction or in this direction, or they can manipulate this. So that is an application of circularly polarized laser pulse to control of electrons, in this case of dynamics. And now this brings us to our field, namely the field of applications of circularly polarized laser pulses. Before I start with our work, I want to praise the works of others. So, for example, Beratka in Halle. He has designed laser pulses which can induce electron rotation, circulation in nanorings. So this is, brings us to nanostructures on surfaces. And the idea, in principle, is very simple. So a circularly polarized laser pulse carries some helicity, and that helicity can be transferred to the motion of electrons. So it's as simple as that. But this is really great work, because it includes dissipation and everything that you need to consider in a dissipative environment. And
is dissipation necessary for the mechanism?
Well, it is, here it's an enemy. They have to fight against, and they showed how to do that. So it's a great work. This is in the field of solids. It was published in the solid state community, and it's not so well known in molecular science people. And a very nice related work by Professor Gross. They also show how to induce ring currents in such rings using circularly. Yes.
In the first case, those are so-called half-cycle pulses, or?
These are, ooh.
They are the first, the nanorings.
I think they use circularly polarized pulses, but Ingo knows better. I don't know whether Ingo knows.
I think it were two linear polarized pulses, but they were perpendicular. First of all, there was, and they had a time delay, the two pulses. Wow. It's like the effect, like the circularly polarized, but they were time delay and linear, I thought.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. So, now you look, still on applications of circularly polarized laser pulses, Fujimura has shown that you can use two perpendicular polarizations of laser pulses to induce electron motion in systems. And these two components are similar to your question, Vaksu. Two perpendicular components are kind of equivalent to a circularly polarized pulse. And also, a circularly polarized pulse has been used to induce electronic ring currents, for example, in the lithium H molecule. And this is work by Nest and Levine and Renato. And this is really tough on the methodological side, so they're really propagating all the electrons of these systems simultaneously. There are not so many, it's just four electrons, but this is hard enough, and they really do this ab initio. So that's okay, so that's the work of others, and I look at my time. And now we really would come to our work. The question is, I would put a time limit like 12 o'clock, because so then we still have 15 minutes. Would that be okay? We would just make a brief tour through our work, which focuses on applications of circularly polarized laser pulses, first on electron dynamics, then to nuclear dynamics. So this is part from nuclear to electron and back. And we apply pi and pi half pulses. So since pi pulses have been one of my favorites since, as you have seen, since 1985, we suggested to apply such pulses also to drive electron, to control electrons. And all the work which is being presented in the next 15 minutes is from Ingo's PhD thesis, and Ingo's just submitted his thesis, and he has published already 13 papers. So we will give a brief resume of some of the contents of his thesis. So the principle is again very simple. So we apply a circularly polarized laser pulse, shine it on a molecule, and then the helicity of the photons will be transferred to the helicity of the electrons in the system. And so here's the concept. We have a circularly polarized pulse. This will induce a ring current or circulation. First of all, this will be electrons, but later we will also consider nuclei, nuclear ring currents. And what is nice is that these ring currents in turn induce a magnetic field. And this magnetic field, as we will see, can be quite strong. And I'm very glad that we have people from NMR here, because eventually one could think of making a link between laser-induced magnetic fields. And they can be switched on very short times, of course, and they are very strong, as we will see, and NMR. So perhaps this can be a possibility to link two fields. Okay, so the model assumptions are, we assume our molecule has been fixed, and there are methods how to fix it in space. Usually we start from the ground state. We don't take into account interactions on long time scales, but just femtoseconds or picoseconds. The principle of these induced ring currents is very simple. If, for example, you have an atom and you have a px orbital, py orbital, we know these can be superimposed to orbitals which contain helicity, so this, for example, would be the plus combination left, and this is right. What you can do to 2px orbitals for the atoms, it's also written here, but you can also do it for molecules, you can do it for other degenerate states, that's important, so your molecule should have a symmetry, so that it allows degenerate states, which can be superimposed to represent ring currents. And the same principle can not only be done for electrons, but also for nuclear states. In the first model system is this magnesium porphyrin, which is very important in biology, so it's a good system to work on. And okay, now I think Ingo has to help to switch on the movie. I want to show some movies which show this laser-driven electron dynamics. What you see here is the laser pulse. So this is the circularly polarized laser pulse. This is the corresponding X and Y component. And here in colors you see the change of the electron density. So red means more electrons than previously, and the green means less. And you see at the end of the pulse, we have the electron density has been changed. And in this stationary state, we have a ring current. Okay, and here's a comparison of this new way of introducing ring currents compared to the old one. So if you use a permanent magnetic field, you can also induce a ring current. First glance, this looks very similar, but the advantages of the laser are enormous. First of all, the effects here are about 100 times stronger than here. For example, the induced magnetic field in the center here, when you want to use induce the same induced magnetic field by an external field, you would need a field of 8,000 Tesla. And that is not available so easily. World record is now in Rossendorf near Dresden, which is less than 100 Tesla. But with a laser pulse, you can do it. And why? Because with a laser pulse, you can excite a full electron, and that can rotate in the molecule. Whereas by the traditional methods, you have, say, 1/100th of an electron, which is moving. Still a ring current, but it's very weak. The other advantage is that laser pulse can be used to control the electron dynamics. That will be shown in the next movie. So you will now show a series of movies that show these effects. And every time the laser pulse is slightly different, and then you see this induces different dynamics. So now, this is Ingo's laptop. I don't know how to. By the way, he did all the PowerPoint presentations. So this is now a different laser pulse from what you have seen before. It's circularly polarized. And you see at the end of this laser pulse, it's not stationary, but it continues. You can, for example, follow these green things here. Okay, you see how this is flowing. It's really, we call this the electron circulation which was induced.
What's the circles on the left there?
This is the laser pulse. This is the X component, Y component. If you make X plus Y, okay. you get the circular polarized pulse.
What is the intensity of the pulse?
Pardon me?
What is the field strength or intensity?
It's in the domain of about 10 to the 12 watts per square centimeter. So not so dangerous. And another one, or maybe we skipped that one.
Didn't get it because he was not looking at the interpreters, so he didn't get it.
Sorry. Okay. So this is another example. Now we have a small molecule, a diatomic, aluminium chloride. And you see the laser pulse is sweeping over the molecule and inducing these toroidal ring currents, the electrons which are now circulating around the axis of the molecule. And the comparison of the big molecule and the small molecule is, in brief, the smaller the better. And the reason is the Biot-Savart law, which says that we induce magnetic fields, so we are now chasing big ring currents and therefore big induced magnetic fields. And this is the larger, the smaller is the radius. So this is a large radius for the charge, and this is a very small radius. So if that is smaller, the field will be bigger, and also if the current will be larger. And the current is, of course, the charge per time. And therefore, a small system is better for having big effects compared to large systems. Now, back to nuclear dynamics. So what can be done for inducing electron motion can also be done for electrons. And now I give the word to Ingo. And during the last 3 minutes, Ingo will tell you, this is a translation of the sign language speakers, the same principle for the nuclear motions. So, Ingo.
I need the microphone.
Oh, you need the microphone.
Okay, it's for the documentation I thought about. Well, do we want to change it?
Yeah, okay. Okay, now we had the electron dynamics, now we're coming back to the nuclear dynamics and control of it. We have, for example, a triatomic linear molecule, and it's aligned by laser pulses. And we use a circularly polarized laser pulse, and it passes, it propagates through the molecule, and so we get a vibrational state of the bands. And it's two degenerated states. One is the X band, and the second is the Y band that's excited. And it's a superposition of these excited states. And so it's creating a pseudo-rotational state. Because of the polarization, the direction of the ring current corresponds to the polarization of the pulse. And as an example, we have two molecules, the CDH2 molecule and the FHF minus. The effects of the electron dynamics are similar to what is of the nuclear dynamics. This is an example for the CDH2 molecule. And the initial state is an electric and vibronic ground state without rotation. It's an ultra-short laser pulse with 50 femtoseconds and circularly polarization. And it excites the system. It's a coherent superposition of several pseudo-rotational states. This is the diagram of a CDH2. The middle molecule is a little one, and the outer ones are the broad probability density of the H of the hydrogen. After the laser pulse, the superrotation goes on because it's a superposition of several pseudo-rotational states. The other example for FHF minus, there I do not have any picture, but there are two movies, and I'll show you in a movie. And we used pi pulses to get from the ground states to the pseudo-rotational excited states with quantum number of L1. And this is a stationary state. So that means after the pulse, it's stationary. In the middle of this molecule, there's the hydrogen molecule. And this, because of it's in the middle, and this is pseudo-rotation, there's excited and induced a ring current. And so I investigated and has shown there's a new hydrogen bond. It's a toroidal hydrogen bond. And now I show you two movies. First is about the CH2 molecule, and the second about the FHF minus. And the time domain and time scale is different. The first one has 50 femtoseconds, and for the second molecule, it's a longer time domain of about several picoseconds. At the beginning, it's the ground state, and on the right, you can see the laser pulse. And this transfers its impulse, its angular momentum, to the nuclei. And after the pulse, they stay rotating. And the second movie is about the FHF minus molecule. It's another time domain, it's a longer time domain. And in the ground state, and now it slowly changes to a stationary state. The outer ones are the F atoms, and in the middle it's the hydrogen. And now it changes its shape into a ring, into a toroidal. And after the pulse passed, it's a stationary one. It's a ring current that's non-zero. It's stationary, but it's non-zero. And it's the same like the electron ring currents. And the ring current in the middle of the molecule is inducing a magnetic field, a very strong magnetic field. And you want to ask or want to go on or? Okay. In the beginning, Professor Munch had shown you the control of with pi pulses to apply them to control the nuclear dynamics for chemical reactions. And using pi pulses for the control of electron ring currents. And now we're coming back with it to the nuclear dynamics to control them. This was my part, and now Professor Munch wants to give the summary and the conclusions, I think.
Okay, so it's 12 o'clock. So 1 minute past. Just this is more like an outlook. I can talk about this longer. Just emphasizing the magnetic fields which can be induced in such systems, and the smaller the better. So in this magnesium porphyrin, it's only 1/10 of a tesla, but in the diatomic molecules we reach 50 teslas, and we can go to other systems which really generate giant magnetic fields. What Ingo has shown just now for the cadmium, you've seen in the middle there was a small cadmium which is rotating on a very, very small ring, and therefore it induces a 300 tesla field. We have other systems which go to 5000 tesla. And so these are fields which are not available in the lab, but which can be induced by laser and which can be controlled. So maybe we can find a bridge here between these two fields.
Very high magnetic fields created by the nuclear ring current, right? They will now interact back on the electron. Have you included that in your simulations?
Not yet. We are thinking about it. Yeah. So since time is so far, the conclusion is what we have shown to you is there was quantum control by laser pulses. We don't know who was the first, maybe these pi pulses in the 70s for the electron, for the atomic systems, but then nuclear dynamics, electron dynamics, and back. For our examples, I have shown to you, or we have shown to you an overview. And finally, thanks to those who support the Deutsche Forschungsgemeinschaft through various projects. And I want to praise in particular something that you see very rarely, namely in Germany we have a support for handicapped academics. And actually the two translators here are paid, and they get like close to $20,000 is paid from Germany to as the translators here, and we are proud of this support for people like Ingo, and we are very grateful for the translators who can induce this. By the way, Ingo is also a docent or a professor of the sign language. He has developed something like 500 new words, like attosecond or quantum interference or whatever, which did not exist in the sign language, to communicate this. And he has trained a group which can speak these words, and you see the result here. And okay, there's a list of papers with Ingo on this field. And this is my group, but it's also very time dependent. This is a snapshot taken 2 years ago, and by now it's changed a lot. I use this as an example to express my deep thanks. We are very happy to cooperate together, but there are many partners worldwide. And we are very grateful, and at the very end, again, many thanks to David, who allowed us to come here, and we look forward to very fruitful discussions during the workshop here. Thank you.